This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
In this two-part episode, we're bringing you the story of Holly Brannigan, a teenager who's home alone, talking on the phone. By all appearances, it's just another typical day in a suburban neighborhood, but danger is looming in more ways than one. And it starts when Holly hears a knock. Someone's at the door.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins on Wednesday, March 28, 1979, on a tree-lined hillside street in an exclusive Pennsylvania neighborhood. Around 4:30 that afternoon, high school senior Holly Brannigan is in her upstairs bedroom, talking on the phone, when someone knocks at the door. She sets the phone down on her bed and goes downstairs. The next morning, March 29th, was overcast and cool when Holly's 18-year-old brother, Sean Brannigan, enters the house. He finds his sister lying face down in a pool of blood on the kitchen floor with a knife sticking out of her back. He calls police. Officers are dispatched to the scene. One of the first to respond is now retired Bethlehem police officer Craig Stefko.
We used to go by codes. 0100 is a murder, 0200 is a rape, 300 is a robbery, 400 is assault. So I got the call. It was a code 0100. It was the 29th of March of 79. And at about 7 minutes to 11, I was at a district justice's office. Dispatch called my number, and I acknowledged, and they said, you know, possible code 0100. I shot out there. When we arrived, I got there. I believe my sergeant was at the door. There's like a little, kind of like a carport. The upstairs deck went around the house, and then there was like a little driveway with pillars and stuff. He was on the top deck, looking in the sliding glass windows, and saw Holly laying on the floor with a knife in her back. And he reported to dispatch that, base, I have a woman with a knife in her back, permission to break in the door. And at that point, the brother walked up the driveway and unlocked the door, let us in, and said, there she is. And then we realized that she was dead. And then the sergeant called in, called for the coroner, and called for investigations.
Detectives begin to arrive, and the house and surrounding property are buzzing with activity. Nearby residents have no idea what's happening in their once peaceful neighborhood. This is a real whodunit. We have a popular high school girl lying dead on the kitchen floor of her upscale home with a large butcher knife sticking out of her back. So who was she, and why would someone kill her? Holly Brannigan was born on December 12, 1961, the second child of Richard and Peggy Brannigan. Peggy passed away in 1976 from leukemia. So it was just Holly, her 18-year-old brother Sean, and her dad living in the modern three-level home. Holly was a senior at nearby Freedom High School. I spoke with one of Holly's close friends and classmates, Sally.
She was reserved until she got to know you, and then she was very fun. She was never like the center of the room, but she did always have something fun to say or do or be. I think she just wanted to fit in, and she did it beautifully. Naturally.
According to the Allentown, Pennsylvania Morning Call, Holly sang in Freedom's senior choir. She was also a manager for the boys' soccer team.
She got with the more popular kids once she was the soccer manager for the high school team, because our team had some good players and most of them were popular kids. So that's when she mainly hit it, and towards our senior year, she found that crew and I found the men's volleyball team. So for the same thing, it kind of elevated us both.
I asked if Holly had a boyfriend.
You know, people have asked me this question over and over, and I don't believe she did. At this point, I'm tempted to say I would like to go back to the grand jury thing where they took all my notes and everything and read through it, and I bet I wouldn't recognize any of it because I've worked so hard to forget. But the only thing I can tell you is I don't believe she did have a boyfriend at the time. If she did, it was something that she did not tell me, which would surprise me.
There were some boys on the soccer team that the girls often talked about.
I know that Holly, you know, thought Dave Elteringham was cute, but she also thought this guy was cute and this guy was cute, and they were all on the soccer team. And, you know, that's what girls do in high school. Well, he's a cute guy. Oh, he's a cute guy. You know, that kind of thing.
By all accounts, Holly was just a normal teenager going to school, looking forward to college, living her life when the unimaginable happened. So let's go back to the morning of March 28, 1979. The residents of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania are waking up to a yet unknown disaster that won't become apparent until later that day. I'm not talking about the murder of Holly Brannigan. I'm talking about the most serious nuclear power plant accident in American history. It's a combination of equipment problems and human error that triggers a partial meltdown in reactor number 2 at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Middletown, Pennsylvania. And as this emergency is unfolding in real time, Holly and her classmates go about their school day as usual, oblivious to the potential catastrophe just 90 miles away. And Holly Brannigan is also unaware that she's on a collision course with evil. As the school day ends, Holly gets a ride home from Sally, who lives just down the street. The two had grown up together and had been friends since kindergarten. Sally drops her off at home. In any murder investigation, the timeline is critical. It can help to prove or disprove statements and alibis, and it can help to identify witnesses and suspects. So, what do we know about the sequence of events in this case? Holly enters her house on Pine Top Trail around 2:30 p.m. No one's there. She's used to coming home to an empty house since her mom died 3 years earlier. Unless, of course, her older brother Sean happens to be home, in between hanging out with his friends, attending classes at Lehigh University, or his job at a nearby gas station. Holly knows her dad's heading to Atlantic City that afternoon for a conference, and he'll likely be leaving straight from work. She goes upstairs to her room, where she kicks off her shoes and changes her clothes. She goes downstairs to the kitchen. She grabs a bowl of cereal and a bottle of Pepsi and heads back up to her room. According to the Allentown Morning Call, Holly's on the phone with a friend at about 4:30 p.m. when she hears knocking at the door. This is the late 70s, so Holly's using a hardline phone. She tells her friend, "Hold on, someone's at the door." She sets the phone down on her bed and goes downstairs. There are side light windows on either side of the front door, so she'd presumably see whoever was standing there. According to a Bethlehem police report, Holly picks up a downstairs telephone extension and says to her friend, "I've got to go. I'll call you back." Did she tell her friend who was at the door? We don't know, but the friend never hears back from her. A March 1989 article in the Gettysburg Times says that the Bethlehem police contacted famed mentalist The Amazing Kreskin for assistance in their investigation. Kreskin used a technique he called stimulation of the imagination. When he spoke with the friend who was on the phone with Holly, the friend recalled hearing a radio in the background while she was waiting for Holly to come back on the line. And using that information about specific songs she heard, police then contacted the radio station and were able to pinpoint the time the call took place, which was about 4:30 p.m. In a Bethlehem police report, an employee where Holly's dad works says that Holly called the Lone Star Industries office at 4:45 p.m., asking if her father had already left for Atlantic City. He had already left, and the employee said that Holly did not seem upset or disturbed at the time. During an interview with police, Sean Brannigan says that he called the house at 5 p.m. to speak with Holly, but the line was busy. He added that the telephone at his residence had a call waiting feature and that he should have been able to get through, but could not. Several hours pass. It's now 11 p.m. Holly's brother calls the house again since he's staying over at her friend's place for the night, but he gets no answer. She's a popular girl, so maybe she's hanging out with friends. It doesn't seem to cause any major concern with Sean at that point. The next day is Thursday, March 29th. As is their normal routine, Sally arrives at Holly's house that morning to pick her up for school.
I drove up and drove under the carport like I always did, beeped the horn, and I waited and waited and waited, and she didn't come out, and I thought that was kind of weird. For whatever reason, I got out of my car. I left it running. And I went to the front door, which has the two windows on either side.
As Sally rang the doorbell, she could see the family's dog inside through the window. The little cockapoo was wagging his tail, happy to see her.
and the dog Clancy was right there, and I love dogs. So I was taken with Clancy, and I'm like, oh, Clancy, how are you? And didn't notice anything different with Clancy. I could hear something. I still say it was her clock radio. I don't know what it was to this day, but I thought that's kind of weird. Maybe she didn't hear my horn or something. So my first thought was go around the side of the house and go up the steps that go to the deck. And I started to do that, and we were raised not to go in anybody else's house or anything, even as close as Holly and I were. It's just not what you do. You don't just walk in somebody else's house. So I got about halfway up the steps, and I just got this feeling, turn around, go back down the steps. I still swear I heard my mom's voice say, stop, go back in the car. And I thought of it more as an etiquette thing. I now, because I am religious, I do feel like it could have been Jesus and mom related. But either way, I went back to my car. I gave one more beep of the horn, and I realized I would be late for school if I waited any longer. I did try calling her once I got to school, because back in those days, I didn't have a cell phone. But I think my first class was in band. So I asked the band director if I could use his phone. And that's when I called, and I got a recording that didn't make sense. It was, you know, boo-doo-doo, I'm sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service, or something like that. I'm not positive that was the message, but it was some, you know, out-of-order type message. And I thought, that's weird. And then after I called after that, all I got was busy signals, which again didn't make sense because I knew she had call waiting.
At about 10:40 that morning, Sean and his friend enter the house. Holly is supposed to be in school, so they're shocked when they find her lying dead on the kitchen floor. They quickly leave. Sean locks the door behind him, and they rush to a neighbor's to call police. Officer Stefko told me about the radio call he received that day.
Neighbor reported that a woman was slumped over a table in the kitchen with a knife in the back. And Unit 160, he was actually the first guy in the scene that went around the deck and saw her and called it in and said permission to break the door in.
That's when Sean Brannigan walks up the driveway, approaching the officers.
If you go up the driveway, there's like a carport. You can drive the car under. There's a door right there. And that's how you go into the house. And you go up the steps, and it's kind of built on a hillside.
Sean unlocks the front door. The officers enter and clear the house to make sure no intruders are still inside.
I then went upstairs to the kitchen area. Unit 160 and the complainant's brother. I forgot that Sergeant Rivnak. He was there too.
They enter the kitchen with Holly's brother, Sean.
The brother left us in. He walked up and very coldly looked at her and said, there she is. I'm like, oh man. Whew. Okay. And then I started doing my work. The complainant was on the kitchen floor, face down with a large knife in her right side. Yes. And at that point, the sergeant just looked at it and said, you know, 22 to base, call the coroner.
Now, you just heard Officer Stefko refer to Holly as the complainant. Some agencies might refer to her as victim or decedent. In this region, they use the term complainant. In addition to recording his observations of the crime scene in his report that day, Officer Stefko also made a rough sketch of the Brannigan kitchen that indicates where Holly's body was found. You can see a rendering of that sketch in our show notes if you want to follow along.
Kitchen area 1, TV set was on and selector was on channel 6. Now, I really don't remember what was on the TV at the time, but that it was, you know, it was on 6. But the counter was up by the sliding glass door. That's where her friend would have seen her if had she walked, and that's where the other officer, Dave McGar, saw her. He looked through that window. Then you had the stove, the sink, the counter, and the refrigerator. 2, the word violator, spelled just like that, was spelled on the freezer compartment of the refrigerator with magnets and 2 larger magnets under VI-O and 8 smaller magnets later, VIOLATER. So to me, that was a possible clue. You know, VIOLATER.
We've seen other crime scenes where the killer leaves a cryptic message for police. You'll remember Charles Manson and Helter Skelter for one. But in this case, it would be later determined that the word violator was a play on words based on the last name of one of Sean's close friends. Stefko continued to make observations about the crime scene. He remembered that the kitchen chairs were not sitting neatly around the table.
The table and the chairs were that way when I first saw her. That's the original place where the chairs were. If you see the arrows, that's the way the seats were facing. In the bottom, the seats were facing the table. The two in the top, one was facing the table, one was facing out towards the door. That is anybody's guess why they were like that. And then there's this type of towel on the refrigerator door, partially hanging by a magnet. And there was one magnet on the floor in front of the refrigerator and one on the side. Now, it's very possible that that was part of the struggle.
I asked Officer Stefko if it looked like there was a long, drawn-out struggle.
No. It wasn't like she was running around the kitchen knocking things over, trying to get away. If I recall, there was no blood on the fridge, because I believe I would have included that in the report. So, and I don't know where the knife came from. That might be in somebody else's report. I'm not even sure. But whoever was there that got the knife, there might have been a struggle. She might have bumped into that to knock a magnet or two down. And to be honest with you, the suspect, I don't even know how big he is. You know, as much as I know the name, I don't recall what he looks like if I ever saw him. I'm just familiar with the name and the family. And I'm assuming, because I think she was probably slight stature, could have very easily, you know, just had his arm around her upper shoulders and neck overpowered her and just kept stabbing her.
Now, you just heard Officer Stefko mention the suspect, and we'll talk more about that later. Let's get back to the crime scene.
Yeah, I believe there's blood like around her chest and upper face area a little bit. You know, it wasn't like all over the place, but there was like a, you know, pooling of blood like normal happens, you know. I mean, she was stabbed 18 times. You wouldn't expect to find a woman stabbed 18 times on Pine Top Trail.
When Officer Stefko searched Holly's room, he saw a half bottle of Pepsi and a bowl with a spoon in it on the nightstand next to Holly's unmade bed. A long telephone cord was running from the master bedroom to the phone which was sitting on the bed. Her wristwatch was on the dresser, and a pair of brown shoes and light blue socks were on the floor. Nothing remarkable was noted in the police report about the state of her room or any of the other bedrooms upstairs, and no mention of any items in disarray, indicating there was probably no struggle upstairs, and nothing seemed to be missing to suggest a robbery motive. Was there anything else found at the crime scene that could be pertinent to the timeline?
And in the mailbox, the Globe Times dated 28th of March, which is the day before. Now, the Globe Times was an evening newspaper and mail, and there was mail in the mailbox. So I would have no idea where on the 20th of March when that would have been delivered. And the mail, you know, maybe she just didn't think about getting it after school. I don't know. That I can't answer.
Officer Stefko questioned Sean Brannigan at the scene. Sean said that he's Holly's older brother and that he lives at the same residence. He attends Lehigh University and works part-time at Renner's Mobile Service Station. He had spent the previous night at a friend's house, the same friend that had accompanied him to the house.
S. Brannigan then stated he tried to call Holly the night before he tried to call her, and he stated that the line was busy. That was probably during the time or after. It had to be after when she left the phone off the hook that he couldn't get through to her because the phone was off the hook all night long. And then he also stated that when he entered the complaints bedroom on the 29th, the telephone was off the hook. And that's how I found it.
Sean said that he and his friend entered his house at around 10:40 that morning, and after discovering his sister's body on the kitchen floor, they went to a neighbor's residence to phone police. Officer Stefko reported that when he'd first arrived, Sean appeared calm. There were no physical signs that he was crying or had been. He wasn't shaking, didn't appear to be in shock, and he was cooperative. When Sean's friend was questioned, he was visibly upset, but he gave the same account as Sean did, adding that another phone call was made to see if Holly was home at 11 p.m. the night before, but the line was still busy at that time. As the investigation continued at the crime scene on Pine Top Trail, a couple detectives were dispatched to Freedom High School. They wanted to talk to Holly's good friend, Sally.
We had some sort of assembly that day, and that's when they took me to the principal's office. My stepmother was on the one couch right outside of the office, and she was crying uncontrollably. And she basically said hello, but they whisked me into the principal, I wasn't sure what was going on at that point. Nobody had told me anything. My father was out of town, and for my stepmother to be there like that, I wondered if something had happened to my dad. I get into the principal's office, and his phone rings, and he picks it up and says, Sally Hancock is not willing to make a statement. And that's all I knew until I got whisked into the police car with my stepmother following, and they weren't talking to me. They weren't telling me anything. I was escorted to my locker to get books. I was told I would not be in school for the next couple of days. And so I grabbed several books. I did, again, I'm crying, but I don't know why. My mind was going 300 miles an hour. I was still convinced it was my dad because of my stepmother being there. Like, I didn't know why she was there. I didn't think about it except other than I guess something happened to dad. Finally, when I get to the police department, that's when the Baker team got me in their office or whatever and said, I guess at this point you realize that Holly was murdered. I'm like, what?
Sally was obviously going through a lot. Not only had her good friend been murdered, but she'd been questioned by police for hours. And if that wasn't enough, she was being harassed on the phone.
Yeah, I was out of school for a couple of days, and I couldn't wait to get back to school because I had already started getting phone calls. I'd pick up the phone and the person would say, you're dead, bitch. I think somebody thought I knew who did it. I didn't. I would have told somebody if I thought I knew who did it. I've never known who did it. But yeah, I was getting phone calls. You know, they'd say that one line and hang up.
If she was hoping for some normalcy at school, she didn't get it.
Everywhere I went, it's like, are you okay? Are you okay? What do you know? What do you know? You know, all of that. I felt like I wasn't really in school anyway. Stuff like that didn't happen in Bethlehem. It was just wacko. Nobody knew what to say or do or think.
As investigators are combing the Brannigans' house, Holly's father is on his way back from Atlantic City, and detectives begin knocking on doors, asking neighbors if they'd seen anything out of the ordinary.
It's an upscale residential area. Most of the homes are larger because her father was an executive for a cement company. So it was a very nice, affluent neighborhood, a lot of lawyers, doctors. So yeah, it was a nice section of town, which is probably what got people so upset or freaked out, because it wasn't like in where you would expect it, like one of the side streets in Bethlehem or one of the housing projects or whatever.
I spoke with a former neighbor of the Brannigans, Eric Dowdle.
My parents, we moved to Bethlehem, Pine Top Trail, in 1970. So growing up in a small town, it was a lot of kids in the neighborhood. There were four houses between our house and the Brannigan house heading up Pine Top Trail. And again, there were a lot of kids on the block. So we were always out in the street playing and that sort of thing. It was a good place to grow up.
Eric and his younger brother, Kurt, knew the Brannigans because of Holly.
I knew them because Holly was our babysitter. My family became quite a connoisseur of babysitters because my brother and I were hellions. She was a nice young girl. She was kind and pleasant. And that's about all I can remember is just, if you ask for anything specific, I can't. If you ask for generalities, I can. And I would say, you know, it's positive. Just a positive feeling. There were some who weren't, but Holly was just a nice young lady.
And there's the odd coincidence between Holly's murder and the movie Halloween, which was released just months before Holly's murder. A horror film where the lead character, a babysitter played by Jamie Lee Curtis, is also attacked by a knife-wielding psychopath. Holly's friend Sally doesn't like the comparison.
And it grinds at me that I know the story about Halloween came out and that she saw it and she was creeped out by it and all that. And she did fit the category of the title character. She was a B student and she babysat. I don't like that connotation attached to it.
Ironically, this was a babysitter who's murdered with a kitchen knife. I mean, it's just creepy and I don't believe in coincidences.
On the next episode of APB Cold Case.
In part two of Someone's at the Door, we delve into some of the theories and motives surrounding Holly's murder.
As I said, there was an awful lot of money, awful lot of power, there's awful lot of prestige, and there were awful lot of people who had access to those things that were in and around where this happened, and you'll never know.
And the first hours of an intensive investigation.
I was now fearful that I was going down for something that I didn't do.
Be sure to listen to part two of Somebody's at the Door about the murder of Holly Brannigan. And don't forget to check out our show notes at apbcoldcase.com.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.